so thrilled that you are doing this about Shirley Chisholm, because she really is one of the great American Gothic leaders. She's just phenomenal. And we just can't forget her because she was such an important role model. I have always cared so much about women's history and been so frustrated that no one seems to really know much about women's history. I find out even in a NOW meeting, I start talking about prominent women in history and what they did, and I find people taking notes. So people just don't know. And the first time I really realized how serious this was I had gotten elected to Congress, and Katharine Graham, who owns the Washington Post, and Jacqueline Kennedy invited me to dinner at Katharine Graham's house. So I thought, well, this is pretty important. Well, let me tell you what it's about. They had given me some little rinky-dink committee dealing with holidays and special days, but they were getting ready for the bicentennial in 1976. So it was a little more important than it normally was. And all this stuff had come along, and I had just passed it out, gotten it through the house without thinking two whits about it. It all made sense to me. It didn't occur to me that it was even controversial. Well, it hit the Senate, and the Senate went crazy. Here's what it was. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis had edited a book called Remember the Ladies. For those of you who know women's history, Remember the Ladies was my wonderful John Adams' wife, Abigail, writing to him when they were doing the Constitution. And, of course, he wrote back and said, forget it, Abigail. But she had called it Remember the Ladies, and she had done all this incredible research about women in American history. There were things about, you know, Martha Washington had spent all 4 winters with the Continental Army. Somehow we always pictured her at home in Mount Vernon doing needlepoint, you know, taking care of the fire and all that. And when it was over, George Washington went to the Continental Congress and insisted they pay her for it. As he said, literally, she was the spark plug that kept the troops from leaving. So it was all sorts of stories like this. Okay. She wanted that to be an official book of the bicentennial. Well, why wouldn't you? You know, I mean, and there were that was the main thing. The boys said no. And I will never forget sitting at the table thinking, what am I even doing in this town? Here are these male senators saying no to the two most powerful women in the city. And they finally, by dessert, came up with a great compromise. And that was, they explained to us over and over again that what they really had envisioned, what they had envisioned for women in the bicentennial, was lots of garden plantings, tulip bulbs and things. And we all said, well, you know, we're all for that, but why can't we have the book too? I mean, you know, the book is done, it's ready. So their final compromise was they would agree to allow it to be in the USIA libraries overseas as part of the bicentennial, but not here. So that's why none of you have ever seen the book. So, I mean, you know, okay, 76, here we are, 2008. People still don't know women's history. And Shirley Chisholm is a very, very, very important part of that. When I ran in 1972, I can't tell you how excited I was to know that she was out there running for president. What an amazing thing. And one of the interesting things about Shirley Chisholm that I noticed was she understood power. A lot of women don't quite know what to do with power, don't quite understand it, feel like they should apologize if they use it. You know, it will be feminine, it will be, she got it right away. What are some of the things that she did? Well, she made life for me a whole lot easier because when she got to Congress, the boys put her on the Agriculture Committee. And she made some wonderful comments about they must have seen the book A Tree Grows in Brooklyn and thought it was an agricultural area. But obviously she didn't want to be on the agriculture. So she complained. This never happened. Freshmen just don't complain. You're supposed to sit in your seat and behave yourself and outlive everybody. Well, she wasn't about to do that. So what did? They put her on the Veterans Committee. Well, that didn't make her very happy either. So there was a race for majority leader, in which an African-American John Connors was running against Hale Boggs, a white Southerner. And Shirley backed Hale Boggs. People were very upset, but Hale Boggs put her on education and labor, which is where she wanted to be. When she was running in 72, she did another thing that was an interesting use of power that some people criticized her for. If you remember the 72 election, Governor Wallace of Alabama, who is not my hero, got shot. And she went to see him in the hospital. And he was like, oh my gosh, what are you doing coming to see me? We don't agree on anything. And she said, no, that's right. But I wouldn't want to see what happened to you happen to anybody. And so I am here as a human being. She said he broke down and cried. Now, a couple years later, she was trying very hard to get domestic workers covered under the Minimum Wage Act. They had always been outside the minimum wage. So she got a hold of her good friend, Governor Wallace, and by golly, he rounded up some votes for her among the Southern boll weevils, we used to call them, the Southern guys who didn't want to vote that way. He got her the votes and she got it passed. So, you know, she would often get criticism for some of this, but she kind of understood power, and if she wanted to get something done, at the end of the day, she tried to play it straight, but if it didn't work, then, you know, she was like, at the end of the day, I'm for the people, and I'm going to do what it takes to get there. The reason I liked her so much was when I got there, I had two young children, and she was literally the only one who was welcoming. I remember Bella Abzug called me and said, you have two young children? I said, yes. She said, I don't think you can do the job. I was like, thank you very much. But Shirley was terrific. I mean, she would spend hours with kids. She loved children. She was fabulous with children. And when I got there, I wanted to be on the Armed Services Committee because there were no women on the Armed Services Committee. Well, there were also no African Americans. And there was a Southern chairman who wanted to keep it that way. It was the first time a chairman's veto had ever gotten overridden by the caucus. And so they put me on Armed Services, and they put Congressman Ron Dellums from Oakland, California. So we thought we were pretty big deals. You know, here we are, we're walking in the first day. We get there, we're all set. And the chairman goes into this rage about how awful it is. It will never be the same again. This is terrible what has happened. Chairman have no power anymore. It's not worth being a chairman anymore. I mean, you know, the whole bit. He says, but the one thing I still control is how many seats there are at the dais. And this girl and this boy don't equal a whole one of any of you. So I'm giving them one chair. So Ron and I shared a chair for 2 years on that committee. It was not a good feeling. But nevertheless, Shirley was very... You know, she said, look, I've been there, you know, remember me, Agriculture Committee? Yeah, keep fighting, you'll win. And sure enough, 2 years later, we were able to defeat that chairman. We got the rules changed so that we elected chairman. And we were able to defeat him as chairman and put someone else in. So, you know, she did some really important things that way and was very, very strong. She didn't play the get-along, go-along. She came to play. Now, later on, you know, she ran for president when I came. But in 1988, I looked at running for president. I keep thinking how I always thought that the world was changing so much faster than it was. That's probably the biggest mistake I've always made in my life. When I got elected in 73, I asked the Library of Congress how long it would be before half the House would be female, like the population. And the answer was 425 years. And I thought, what? But now I'm beginning to think maybe they're right. I mean, here we are, all these many years later, and we still don't have anywhere close to that number. We don't even have a critical mass of any minorities or women. It's still basically a predominantly white organization, although it's better. So you look at how slow that is. When Geraldine Ferraro went on the ticket in 1984, I thought, this is great. Big Mouth here went around saying, we will never have a ticket again in America without this kind of diversity, right? Well, I was totally wrong, because we haven't had a ticket of diversity yet. since 1984. But in 1988, I had started out as Gary Hart's campaign manager. And I had pushed him against the wall and said, now tell me, are these rumors true? And he's like, oh, I can't believe you asked. How can you do this? Well, of course, it turns out the rumors were true, and Donna Rice appears, and he is out of the race. So I thought, well, you know, there's no women running this time, and there should be diversity, and I have cleared my calendar to help Gary, so why don't I run for president? So away I went. And it was really eye-opening. It was so amazing, the things that you experience. My favorite question, and this would be from people in the media, why are you running as a woman? And you can tell by the things that she read before I came up here, I suffer fools lightly, and I have a broad definition of fools, and so it got to be harder and harder to figure out how I was going to finally respond. Well, what should I have done? Run as a horse? Run as a... When did I get to check the box? I don't remember. You would finish a whole speech on nuclear power or something, and someone would say, why are you wearing green? Or how do you wear your hair when you're dressed up? Or are you wearing earrings or should you not wear earrings? I mean, all this stuff that you could not possibly believe. I remember one reporter, you may remember her well, she still writes for the New York Times, yeah. Marie Dowd, who I always figured would be an assassin if she weren't a journalist. But she was following me around one time on the campaign trail, and it had been a morning where you're trapped in lots of places, and I was just a little rinky-dink, low-level candidate. It's not like you have all sorts of people helping. And I had lost the bag to keep my jewelry in, and I needed to change to pearls later in the evening because we were in the South somewhere. And if I didn't have pearls, I figured I had pearls on with blue jeans and I'd be all right. But if I didn't have pearls, these were the ladies who say, horses sweat, men perspire, and women do. You know, and being from the West, I never quite got that. But I did know I needed the pearls. So I had the pearls in my purse, in a bag. We go in, I'm getting ready for the thing. Maureen's standing there. I pull them out. It's in a bag. She writes this whole article. How can somebody be president of the United States when they keep their jewelry in a baggie in their purse? And I'm like, what? I mean, it's those kind of things that make you just a little bit nuts. You begin to think, I got in this to talk about the big issues, and here I am talking about my hair, my looks, my, you know, why I'm a woman, all this stuff. It's amazing. My very favorite was being introduced by a Southern chairman, and I really thought for a while there it was going real well. He was like, I like this lady, this is a fine lady, this lady knows more about the armed services than all those other candidates put together. And I think it's time we have a woman in the White House. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I should rethink all of this, what's going on? And then he says, however, I do not want a man for first lady. Then, okay, well, there you go. Now you're supposed to come up to the podium and make some kind of sensible speech out of this. We want to say, you what? So it's been, it was really quite an experience. Obviously, I was the last one in because everybody else had already been in, and there were seven candidates already in. Some of the press called the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which I don't think the guys liked particularly well. People were wonderful. People came out of the woodwork and helped. It was just an amazing experience, how generous and terrific and wonderful people were. But both Time Magazine and another one ran a poll, and it was very, very, very clear. I was never, never going to make the top cut. I was always going to be number two or number three. I got the highest accolades on trustworthiness, on all those kind of things. But in a head-to-head, they just couldn't quite go with a woman. Yeah, I mean, it was just something about it. Now, I've given it a lot of thought. I'm not really sure why we're so hesitant about women and why other countries have been much more willing to move to put women as heads of state. I think part of it is, we say, President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief, Leader of the Free World. Well, at that time, we had never had a Secretary of State that was female. And we'd never had a Secretary of Defense that was female. And so there was this notion that, you know, this macho thing of how could you possibly be the commander-in-chief, leader of the free world, and all that. And when you think about how important visuals are, people used to say to me all the time, it's so exciting that you're in this race. All the rest of them look alike, dress alike, sound alike, talk alike, but you don't look presidential. And I'd say, yeah, I know. No one's ever looked like me that we're in for president. And yet that visual was so important to people. And there was just an awful lot of people that could not get over that stumbling block. Oh, another favorite question I got from the press. I got this 32 times. I couldn't believe it. Does your husband know what you're doing? I just said, what? What do you think the Porter man would think? So anyway, it was very clear we did not raise the amount of money we really needed, and they don't give you discounts for getting in late or being female, and we weren't going to make it, no matter what I did, it just wasn't going to happen. So I did get out. I shed a few tears, and oh my gosh, you would have thought I'd had a total nervous breakdown. And it was mainly women. It was like, okay, that's it. She cried, women can never run again, this is terrible. Meanwhile, the guys are all blubbering all over the place. I kept a crime file, it was like this. They were showing their tender, wonderful sign. But somehow women wouldn't do that. And we're still seeing traces of that, you know. I mean, it's just really, you keep thinking, what is it they want? If we go back to the visual again, if you were tasked to dress a male candidate, you'd know what to do. You put on a dark suit, a white shirt. They have a tie. If they're looking like they're working, they loosen the tie. If they're really looking like they're working, they take their shirt, their coat off, they throw it over their shoulder, they're running down steps, they got a phone in their ear. But we know all of those images because we've seen them over and over and over. They're just automatic. They're in our head. Okay, now you've got a woman candidate. What are you going to do with her? And the problem is she either looks like a Vogue model or an unmade bed. Yeah, I mean, really, we don't, what does a working woman look like? I remember as a little girl, they used to have refrigerator ads where the woman would be all dressed up in high heels, opening the refrigerator. I mean, no one knew what to do with all of this stuff. So we're still working that out. I also think in other countries, they have had women leaders. In England, the best kings have been queens. Let's be very honest about it. Victoria, Elizabeth, they've had whole eras named after them. And then they've had guys like George III who almost blew the whole thing. So they've had very strong women. If you look at Russia, they've had czarinas. And if you look at all sorts of other places, they have had women as leaders, so it's not quite as shocking to their system. When you look at the United States of America, when we passed the Equal Rights Amendment, God love the people in Hawaii. They so wanted to be the first people to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment after the Congress passed it, that they kept a plane running at National. They could pick the papers up and fly them to Honolulu so they could get them through. Little did they know they could have taken a banana boat, you know, the slowest one around, and still been first because there was no rush. Now again, why was Hawaii so gung-ho for all this? Why has Hawaii always been progressive? They sent us Patsy Mink, who many of you may remember. Well, she also looked at running for president. They now have a very distinguished, Macy is their new congresswoman, it's just fantastic. They've got a woman governor, they've, you know, had women for everything. Well, they had a queen, Lili Kalani. And, you know, while Kamehameha may have gone out and knocked heads together to unite the islands, the real uniter was the queen, who wrote the poetry and the music and the things that kind of tied the people together culturally. And the people have great respect for that. And so there's just, you know, we don't quite have that tradition. We actually have that tradition, we just don't know that tradition because, again, we didn't know Martha Washington went to all of the Revolutionary War sites in the winter, and we didn't know about the Ludington sisters. We all knew about Paul Revere, who rode through Boston. The Ludington sisters did the entire state of Connecticut. It's just no one wrote a poem about them. So they were there, and they were doing great things. In our culture, we just don't have it. Some of my favorite letters that I got when I was running for president were people trying to help me look more presidential. Someday I ought to pull those out and just read them to people, because I think you'd all get such a kick out of it. There were things like, maybe if you played touch football with your husband and had it filmed. Maybe if you wore a policewoman's uniform. Why would I do that? Not a policewoman. Yeah. Maybe if you... people were trying to be very nice. I mean, they're trying to think of things. Now, they do this with men, too. I mean, you remember the first George Bush driving around in a speedboat eating pork rinds or something. It was like, please. And you remember Dukakis sitting in a tank with a stupid fool. But so they do that with men, too. We don't have the uniqueness of women, but it's much harder for women because an awful lot of men have been able to pull it off. Well, Carrie's windsurfing, that didn't work too well either. But that it's just almost impossible to think of something a woman can do to look that way. So we're evolving, and it's slow. It's been wonderful to see the women senators move in. They've done a very good job. One of the depressing things to me has been we had a very strong women's caucus. It was bipartisan. We only let people in that believed in choice and the Equal Rights Amendment. But we let men in as affiliate members. So we were the largest caucus around. And that's how we got so much legislation done in that one window that we could get done, which was about 93 to 96. But the minute Newt Gingrich came in, he changed all the rules. He was so intimidated by this caucus. So that it couldn't have offices on the Hill anymore. We couldn't donate staff to it. We had to go out and raise money from outside funders, which then kind of corrupted it all, because the first people in line that wanted to fund us were, of course, the cigarette people. And we're like, no, that's not going to work. So, it really took away the power we had to work together. And when there are so few women, the Black Caucus has got the same problem, the Hispanic Caucus has got the same problem. When there's so few, if you can't have that strong nucleus there on the Hill, it kind of gets dispersed and you don't get as much done. And that's kind of what's happened. So that's one of the things that's transpired in that period of time. I keep hoping that we're going to see a change. I keep hoping. I see all these young people come in. I keep hoping that they just get so mad they go run for office. When I left Congress, I went to teach at Princeton. I was teaching at the Woodrow Wilson School. Graduate school. Now, it's the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Service. Huh? Public service, you think? Okay. So, I walk in the first day and I see everybody say, this is terrific. How many of you are going to run for office? And no hands go up. And I said, am I in the right place? Now, this is public service. Am I in the right place? Oh, yeah, you're in the right place. Well, what are you people planning to do? And they all said, well, we'd like to be somebody like George Stephanopoulos. And I'm like, no. You got to go run for Senate. You got to run for House. We don't want to do that with our lives. And I'm like, that's the biggest mistake in the world you could make. The Shirley Chisholms of the world must have rolled over in their grave when they heard that. No. You've got to go out and take it on. And people keep looking for the perfect job. There is no perfect job. If everything was perfect, we wouldn't need a government anyway. So, the thing is to go up and try and clean it up, see what you can do, have a lot of fun. She was always terrific in saying, you don't let people get down. You don't accept the status quo. You go challenge it. You go fight it. That's what our system's about, where you don't have to accept the status quo. So I'm hoping that young people start saying, they're not going to accept the status quo anymore, and they're going to take it back, because I do think we have kind of squandered an awful lot of our young people's futures, and that's really not fair. And so we really need to pull it back and see what else we can do. I could talk forever about all of the other things that I really, really care about when it comes to the women's movement. I think it's been marvelous what's happened with women in education. When I grew up, I had my pilot's license when I was 14, and I really wanted to be an aerodynamic engineer. That's what I wanted to be. I was Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And I got to college, and my advisor said, no, you can't do that. I said, why? He said, well, because nobody will hire you. Your parents are paying for this tuition, and when you get done, what are you going to do with it? Hang it over your changing table that you have an aerodynamic degree as you change diapers? That wouldn't happen today. That absolutely wouldn't happen today. When I got elected to Congress, I came from a state that had passed the Equal Rights Amendment and had passed it in the state. I'd taken it for granted. We bought a house in Virginia. I go to close on the house. I'm a Harvard lawyer, for heaven's sakes. I'll go close on the house, sign the papers. I showed up and they said, no, you can't sign them. So what? You're of childbearing age. I said, what? This is Virginia, 1972. What do you mean I'm childbearing age? They said, well, no woman of childbearing age can sign any kind of a loan or mortgage paper. I said, I'm a member of Congress. Doesn't matter, you're childbearing age. Has to be your husband that signs it. I went to get a credit card, and here comes the lead woman. They sent a woman, of course, lawyer from that firm, who says, you can't have a credit card in your own name. I said, I have to. I'll go to jail otherwise. I can't charge my congressional expenses to my husband. Well, no, that's how it has to be because you're of childbearing age. So I had to do things through Colorado to live in Virginia. It was crazy. But, I mean, to young people today, I'm sure that sounds really weird, but that really all happened. We worked so hard to change the equal credit law. After that, obviously, I was a little obsessed about this and said, women ought to have equal credit. Damn it. And our then equivalent of Greenspan was a guy named Arthur Burns. So, we passed the bill, everything I thought was terrific, and I still kept getting these women from my district complaining about it. They couldn't. So we had Arthur Burns come over to meet with the women and said, what's going on here? And he said, well, you met just for shopping, didn't you? And we said, no, we didn't meet just for shopping. We said equal credit, you know, equal credit for women, whatever it is they want to do. He had it interpreted that we could get equal credit for retail. Anything that you wanted to buy would be just fine. You wouldn't have to have your husband's signature, but everything else, he was sure we didn't mean that. So, those are the kind of really crazy things that got knocked down. We had a survey done, and I remind you, the Equal Rights Amendment has still not passed. We had a survey done of all the laws that would have to be changed if the Equal Rights Amendment had passed. It was amazing what the stuff we found. Just went on and on and on. There are states that don't allow a woman to be an executrix of her husband's will. There are places, you know, so you have to go pay money to a lawyer and on and on. Lots of things like that. But one of my favorites was the Defense Department would fly Boy Scouts anywhere they wanted to go free of charge, but not Girl Scouts. But our favorite was when we did a survey of the National Institutes of Health, that wonderful group that does all the research on our health that we're all very proud of because it's really premier in the world. And we found out there were no women in any of the studies. Any. They didn't even use female rats. They had done a breast cancer study on men, not women. Now, Barbara Mikulski, who's now a senator from, and I marched over there and said, what is this? And they very nicely said to us, how dare you politicize science? This is terrible. And we said, well, why are there no women? And they said, it's simple. You drop a net over a random group of men, and they're all in the same metabolical state. But you drop a net over a random group of women, and they can be in all these different metabolical states. They can be pregnant, they can be in their menstrual cycle, they can be postmenopausal, they can be menopausal, they can be all this. It's just so complex. And we said, well, couldn't those different metabolical states require different treatment? Oh, yeah, they said, but we just don't want to deal with that. So we said, so basically, if you're a woman, you may as well go to a vet, right? And of course, they didn't think it was funny. But anyway, after long, my medical school refused to ever let me on campus again until, of course, we passed it, and then they wanted me back, and they wanted all of the grants to do women's health. So you know how it goes. But incredible. So we have done our time, and I, as I say, I could tell you more stories like this till we all fall through the pool. The thing is, we got to go forward. We got to do more. And we got to stand on Shirley Joseph's shoulders. So thank you very much, and let's now do our two and our peers.
Your story about 1972, some of you who have read or heard me read my memoir in 1968 when I had a lump on my breast and I had to go get a biopsy done. And in the state of Washington, a woman could not even sign her own medical report. The biopsy, my husband had to do it. So you didn't even own your own breasts. And the doctor said to me, I kid you not, I saved it, and it's, I mean, I remember the quote he said, because women are too irrationally and emotionally attached to their breasts, they can't make a decision. Now, we know what men are emotionally and irrationally attached to. So anyway, that law was changed by 1970. I wanted to ask you a few questions about your relationship with Shirley Chisholm. And in particular, what kind of legislation did you work on together? What was successful? What wasn't successful?
Well, Shirley was amazing. She was really for people. And she was for anything that made people's lives better, especially low income. I got there right after her mega child care bill had been vetoed by Nixon. He accused her of trying to Sylviatize America's children. And the Congress has not acted with such a comprehensive child care bill since, which is really pretty amazing. It was about 1971, I believe, that that got vetoed. But it was a very comprehensive child care bill. If you know people in Canada or anywhere else, you know that they're way ahead of us and what they do on child care. So we kept working on that. We had child care days. We had, you know, people, we would ask staff to all bring their children to the office one day just to remind people how needed child care was, things like that. Obviously, the domestic worker she was very interested in. She's very interested in anything of that whole range. The other amazing thing, though, too, is she was not afraid to tell people how to use power. One of the days that I was telling you that I recall is a group of women in Brooklyn had saved a lot of money and come up on buses to Washington to talk to Shirley and I about child care. And Shirley went to the microphone and she said, "You have wasted your money. Why did you come here to talk to me? You had me before, you have me after, you have me all the time, and you got Pat Schroeder too. You've got to go down the hall and talk to people that didn't vote for him," which is absolutely right. I mean, she was always trying to organize and put the power forces together to get something done. Because it's a very difficult body to do it. If you care about children, youth, families, low-income people, guess what? They don't have political action committees. They don't have money to throw around. Those are not seen as power and swishy issues. The press doesn't cover them. You don't get on the Sunday talk shows talking about them. So, you know, it's very simple. She also was very much against the draft. She was against the Vietnam War. And just every progressive issue I can think of, Shirley was there and ready to go on.
In the 70s, there was quite a group of very important pioneering women in the Congress. You mentioned Bella Abzug, yourself, Patsy Mink, Liz Holtzman. Could you talk a little bit about how you all worked together? because I can assume you also were powerful and you had your egos too and your issues.
No, we were, I mean, I think we were so outnumbered that we really realized we had to work together. Patsy used to reserve a table in the members' dining room, I think it was Thursday at lunch, so we could all go over and check in and find out what was going on. And we tried to keep our staffs all connected because things could happen so fast, so fast. Title IX, the famous Title IX. I can't tell you how many times there would be some guy on the floor trying to undo Title IX.
Now, excuse me, just one second. Does everybody in this room know what Title IX is?
Title IX is the Equality in Education, and it meant sports, but it also meant all education. But the jockocracy in the Congress absolutely hated Title IX because they didn't want to share the sports facilities with women. And so, yeah, there was always, we had to be very close because every now and then you looked up and somebody was down on the floor trying to undo everything you worked on. We were totally aware that we never had a total victory. It was just a beachhead. And if we didn't protect that beachhead 24/7, it would be gone overnight. My favorite was when the leadership asked us, is there something we can do for you ladies, not the ladies, that would make you all really happy with this, wouldn't cost any money, but, you know, we could. And it's like, yeah, right, why don't we have nice old ladies' day or something, and put it on grocery sacks and say, aren't we wonderful? No, no, no. But that's always kind of what they wanted. Don't stir anything up, but do something so we'll all be popular with women voters. So we were constantly facing that.
In 1977, you and Shirley Chisholm and many other women in Congress went to this very famous meeting in Houston for women's rights. I believe all the president's wives were there with the exception of Jacqueline Onassis. And would you talk about that experience, how you all worked together?
Shirley and I went together. We took a plane out of Washington and had some equipment problems, so they landed in Atlanta and we sat on the ground for I don't know how long. When we finally got into Houston, I think we'd been traveling for 12 hours at that point, and it was snowing. They had never seen snow in Houston, and the local hostess that was to pick us up was a wreck. She'd never seen snow, she couldn't drive yet. So Shirley and I are like, okay, we'll drive your car, it's okay, don't worry, we'll get you there. Well, we got there, and it was very, you know, it was very exciting, and it was one more of those times where you thought, yes, we've done it, this is great, we've won. And then there were the follow-up meetings in some of the other places. This was after the bicentennial, they had these meetings around America. And when I got to Indianapolis, it was really quite different. You know, there were all these buses that had come in from evangelical churches with guys with walkie-talkies ordering people what to do and telling them where to go, and we almost didn't get out of there alive. So Houston was the high point. Indianapolis was probably the low point, and others were moderately in between. So you realize the world wasn't there yet.
And the issue in Houston, if I'm not mistaken, was Betty Friedan changing her position on lesbian and gay liberation.
Right.
Did you and Shirley ever talk about issues like that? Do you remember how you...
I don't think we ever talked about that one, to be perfectly honest. Shirley and I were really more kind of, yeah, let everybody do whatever they want, but our real focus was always the meat and potatoes of, do people have health care, do people have child care, do they have what they really need, and thought that we ought to be really rooted in doing those kind of things.
When she ran for president, like what happened with you, and even as a congresswoman, she was married, could you describe the strain on a marriage, especially since gender roles are reversed, and what you saw with Shirley Chisholm and Conrad Chisholm?
Well, I think it's very hard. Shirley used to tell me how they really couldn't even go out to dinner because she would just get mobbed, that she would try and wear a wig or she'd try and, you know, kind of disguise herself. But She obviously was so distinct that people would uncover her, and they would be all over, and they wouldn't even be able to be out to dinner. So I'm sure he got a little tired of being the tail of the kite or the purse holder or whatever. It gets old very, very fast. They have been great allies. One of the things they had done is formed different clubs. They had helped form the Unity Club here in Brooklyn and the Bedford-Syverson Political Club and other things. So it wasn't that he wasn't political. He was very political. But I think it got old. I think it is still very hard for a man. My husband and got some other guys together and formed the Dennis Thatcher Society. This is the way they dealt with it. And their motto is, yes, dear. And the rule is they only meet where they can sign their wife's name on the bill. So they think they're very funny. Well, British thought it was very serious that this was a group that really liked Dennis Thatcher. So when Margaret Thatcher was prime minister, every time she would come to town, they would call and say, do you want to entertain Dennis? He's going to be here. And so they would. They'd take Dennis out, and Dennis was absolutely relieved to have someplace to go other than all this other stuff where he was the purse holder. But I wish Jim had saved it. Dennis would have these letters that he got from men in America that were very, very fun. But there was a classic one that I mentioned only because we're in New York. He had one from a guy who was asking him for tips because his wife had just become president of the Long Island Garden Club. And he didn't know if he was going to be able to handle it. And Dennis was like, what's going on over there? But there's no question it is a huge issue. And as I mentioned to you, to me one of the great tragedies is we had Martha Griffiths from Michigan who introduced and got the ERA going. And her husband got ill and she retired to take care of him. Had she stayed, she would have been head of Ways and Means. Mm. I mean, she was in front of Danny Rousinkowski and would have been head of Ways and Means. Wow. And of course, Shirley left when her second husband was in that terrible automobile accident. And had she stayed, she would have been chairman of Education and Labor. So these women seem to be more prone to quitting to take care of the spouse, too, than the men. We have yet to have a male spouse leave to take care of the wife.
Sandra Day O'Connor as well.
Sandra Day O'Connor did the same thing, and how we wish she were still on the Supreme Court, believe me.
Could you comment, even though you weren't a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, what Chisholm spoke to you about, her relationship with the Congressional Black Caucus, or what you observed?
Well, the Black Caucus, she helped found, but when she ran in 1972, there were a lot of them who were like, why her, you know? And a lot of them tried to say it was a vanity campaign and she was crazy. And she got a lot of pressure because the Black Panthers endorsed her and she wouldn't say, no, I don't want their support. So she got an awful lot of criticism that way. And I don't think she ever felt very welcomed in the Black Caucus after that. She went to the meetings. I probably shouldn't say this because I wasn't in those meetings, but she made many comments about how she felt it was harder to be a woman than it was to be African American at many times. And she was very active in the Women's Caucus with the Equal Rights Amendment, with NOW, and all of these other organizations, and I think she found that much more of a home, sadly. But there weren't any other women in the Black Caucus at that time. And the guys just, decided that she was too a showboat or something. I mean, they really tried to be very dismissive of her.
We're now going to open up to any of you who have questions. And when I call on you, just say who you are, okay, for Congresswoman Schroeder.
Hi, my name is Marissa. I'm a student here. And I'm sure you're aware that the campaign going on between Barack and Hillary Clinton has divided the feminist movement around pretty typical class and race lines, with it being, you know, mainly women who are part of the sort of like white upper class older feminist movement who are backing Hillary, and those who are not backing Barack, and people saying things like feminists should vote for Hillary because she's a woman. And I was wondering if you felt like that was, you know, a sort of valid reason to cast a vote, and also what your thoughts were about the divides that it reveals in the feminist movement today.
Well, I'm very troubled about the divides that I am seeing on the race and gender issue in this thing. I don't think it's the candidates. I think the candidates are going to be fine. It's their supporters I'm worried about, because the supporters get so, you know, caught up with their candidate. The old adage about Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Now, think about that. Think how many people couldn't stand John McCain, but by golly, when he, you know, that's it, okay, everybody loves him now, that's it, overnight, you know, boom. Democrats aren't that way. They're like, well, my guy didn't get him, I think they ought to go home, you know, which is really crazy. There is so little difference between the two candidates issue-wise. You're talking about Hillary and Barack Obama. It's very small. So basically, if you're going to campaign, I keep trying to explain to people, look, if you're going to campaign, you've got to have some reason for why you're running. You can't say, well, you know, I'm running because of the 5% difference we have between the two of us. So basically, you know, one is saying I have a lot of experience, and the other is saying, well, you know, maybe we don't need experience, maybe we need a fresh face, maybe we need a new look, you know, and that's where they are. I hear people saying, oh, it's such a dirty campaign, it's such a, I'm like, you people don't even know what dirty is. This is about as far from dirty as I've ever seen. The other thing is, it's only been 4 months since Iowa. I know it seems like 4 years, but it's only been 4 months. And I really think it's kind of nice that everybody's getting to have a say. All the states that didn't run up to be on Super Tuesday are getting a lot of attention that they've never had. For the party, it's very good because we're building organization in all these states we never had before. So we will have some organization on the ground. The trick is going to be, when it's over, whether people can come together again. I don't think feminists can say, you have to vote for Shirley, or you have to vote, I'm doing the same thing you are, you have to vote for Hillary because she's a woman. I don't think that African Americans could say, you've got to vote for Barack Obama because he's black. I think the real issue is, where are we and which set of skills that these two people bring, which set do you think is what we need now? And have a debate about that. And I'm sorry that the other stuff comes in, because it's just not what it should be. I mean, that's just not what we should be talking about. We should be talking about all of these critical things that this country's going to have to deal with, and how do we get out of this hole? George Bush has never learned the first law of holes. When you're in one, stop digging. This guy just keeps digging and digging and digging. So whoever gets there is going to fall right into that hole. Whoever gets it, it's going to be a bloody tough thing. There's no money left. There's nothing but debt left. There's IOUs all over the place. Any of the promises either one of them make are going to be almost impossible to keep because of the lack of funds. And so, I hope people tone it down and keep it back on the level of, who do you think has the skills to go forward? It's not happening. I just came from North Carolina, and it was so polarizing, it was just awful. At the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, some of the young Obama kids booed the governor. And then the people who were backing Hillary, you could just see the hair standing on the back of their neck, that you don't act like that, this is North Carolina, you know, we have civility. And so I really don't like seeing all that happening, and I'm very troubled by how we fire hose everyone down and say, people, we don't stop messing around and we'll end up with John McCain. You like John McCain? You're going to love the draft. Guy's got to do a draft if he does this. There's no way he can keep putting military everywhere. It's a disaster. So let's help people get it back in focus as to what campaigns do.
My name is Marie Shear. I got my bachelor's and master's here, and when I got my master's just before graduation, my thesis advisor told me that I was the best of the interns, but that he would not recommend me for a job after graduation because no one will hire a woman anyway. And the only thing that was unusual about that was that he said woman instead of the girl. I call those the pre-hypocrisy days. My question is, in regard to the two approaches to ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment, one, introducing it and starting from scratch, versus the other one, getting three additional ratifications to add to the 35, which do you support?
Obviously, option two is a whole lot easier at this point. And why is there a time limit on equality? Now, I think the Equal Rights Amendment was about the only amendment that I can think of right now where they put a time limit on it. There may have been another one, but I can't. My slow brain is not calling it up. So it's like, okay, here's this Equal Rights Amendment, but you only get so many years to get this thing through. If you don't get it through, you're never going to be in the Constitution. Well, what's fair about that? Now, the other thing I've always said about the Equal Rights Amendment, too, is I'm willing to negotiate if they're willing to say, okay, we're not treating women equally. They don't get an equal shake in any of the government programs. They don't get equal pay. They don't get the Senate, did you notice, 2 weeks ago, just turned down equal pay again? It was like it was 1950 all over again. I couldn't believe it. So women are preordained to stay at 77 cents or whatever. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll give all women a 30% cut on their taxes. You know, you shouldn't have to pay as, or a 50% cut on your taxes, you shouldn't have to pay as much to a government that doesn't treat you equally. That seems fair to me. If they negotiate, I might negotiate, but they won't. So I want it, and I want it done before I die. I think if you go back and try and start over again, it's forever. So I think at least you do too. And then let's see some scholars explain why this is the one thing that it has to have a time limit on it when no one else did. It's ridiculous. So, you know, in Florida, they got it out of the Senate. They got it ready, and then the Speaker of the House refused to put it on. He said he had more important things to do.
Yes?
My name is Warren Bronx. I'm interested in your views on two points. One you've alluded to, seniority. I know you mentioned Shirley Chisholm on the Agriculture Committee. Will that ever disappear? And number two, I believe you are during the age of proportional representation here in states in the primaries. The Republicans, as you know, are winner take all, and we're seeing the effect of this. Are you still, probably you back that, are you still in favor of that as you evaluate? I hope there are two, you're supposed to ask a single question, but I have asked you a multiple. Bear with me.
Seniority's tough. I come from a little state, Colorado. So seniority is one way you compensate for little states. However, I think what Nancy Pelosi's done is right, and that is they have to rotate every 6 years, the chairmanship, so nobody owns the chairmanship anymore, so we don't have chairman like the one I dealt with. No, I didn't like the seniority system when I came, as was the brunt of it. I think she's found a nice balance for it, and I hope they keep it. People tell me in Congress that the funniest caucus of the year was the first one when Nancy announced they were going to stay with the six-year rule, and that all these octogenarians who now have committees stood up and howled and screamed, and when I said, boy, you talk about people who really have a lot of confidence in American medicine, you know, that are 82 saying, you can't limit me to 6 years. You know? So anyway, I wish I had been there. I guess it was great fun. The proportional thing, my problem with the proportional thing is I think Harold Ickes made it much too complex. I don't have a problem with doing a 60-40, but now he's broken it out to all of these these congressional delegations, our congressional districts and stuff, and it's just so damn complex you can't explain it to anybody. If it had been winner take all, Hillary would have won by now, a long time ago, it would have been shut down. So I think we really feel as close as it is, it should have gone. When you really think about McCain and how many votes he's gotten, it was almost none. And yet he won with the winner take all thing. So I think the proportional thing, but without going deeper than the state, that going congressional district to congressional district just makes no sense. I also, and I come from a caucus state, I think caucuses should be outlawed. Caucuses are outrageous in that they really keep so many people from participating. If you're not there at that day, at that hour, and can't find the place where you're supposed to go, and so forth and so on. But Western states have them, and they love them. And I really wish we could get away, get rid of the caucuses.